Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We don't often think about cuisines being endangered, but what do you know about the food from the Portuguese colony of Macau in China? Take 400 years of Portuguese colonization, with those Portuguese sailors bringing cinnamon, chilies, and curries from their travels, adding their tastes of home, salt cod, paella rice, pastry, settle them in Macau with Chinese tastes, and you've got a rare hybrid, Macanese cuisine. Now, who is there to preserve these tastes? Well, the chef owners behind Chicago's Fat Rice, a restaurant determined to keep the recipes of Macau alive. Well, stay with us for lots more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This episode of The Splendid Table is sponsored by NatureBox, the subscription service providing smarter snacking with nutritious treats like banana bread granola and honey crunch crisps right to members' doors. 50% off your first order at naturebox.com/splendidtable.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. How much do you really know about the meat on your dinner plate? Journalist Christopher Leonard spent more than a decade covering the country's biggest meat companies, and he's written a new book, The Meat Racket: The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. Journalist Jennifer Ait Lee talked with him.
Christopher, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you make a bold claim in your book where you compare farmers in America to serfs. What gave you the confidence to make that comparison?
Well, first of all, it was years of reporting on the ground in the small towns where most of the big meat companies in my book operate. And, you know, a serf was a peasant and sort of the lowest ranking person in the feudal system of agriculture many hundreds of years ago. A serf didn't really own their own land, and importantly, they were tied to a lord who told them what to do. And to be honest, I found a very similar situation when I went to small towns like Waldron, Arkansas, where Tyson Foods has an enormous chicken production facility, and where it contracts out with farmers to raise chickens. And contract farming is a very interesting structure. You'll have a farmer who will borrow maybe $500,000, maybe as much as $2 million to build a large industrial footprint of these kind of factory farms you might have seen, where they could raise 25,000 chickens in a single barn. But for all the size and scale and sophistication of these farms, the farmer never owns the actual chickens that are put into these barns. The farmer contracts with a company like Tyson, and Tyson will come and deliver birds and deliver feeds, and the farmer is paid to raise the animals. But the farmers have almost no control over the most important things in the operation. The farmer has no control over what quality of chicks are delivered to the farm, whether they're healthy or not. The farmer doesn't control what kind of feed is delivered to the farm. Tyson Foods was a pioneer in developing this system of contract farming, and Tyson really experimented. They had some operations where they would own the farm itself. They had others where they would hire employees to come and raise the chickens. But what they discovered was that really a factory farm is an awful investment, and a lot of that can be traced back to these actual giant barns, these chicken houses, as they're called, which are just a rotten investment. The things start to lose the value pretty much the day they're finished being built. They're kind of like trailer homes. They corrode in the elements. They serve no other purpose than to raise chickens. And it's not something that appreciates with value. So Tyson and other companies made the decision back in the 1960s that they would go with this arrangement of contract farming and that Tyson would effectively control the farm without owning it. And that sort of rotten investment would be on the balance sheet of the local farmer.
And you have this verb called chickenization or chickenizing. What does that mean?
Yeah, chickenization is a funny word. But when you spend a lot of time going around to small towns in rural America where raising meat is still the economic bread and butter, the phrase chickenization is actually a pretty loaded political term. At its most basic element, when you call a meat business chickenized, what you're saying is that it's vertically integrated or very tightly integrated. And by that, I mean a company like Tyson Foods will own all of the components of raising meat that used to be a small business in small-town America. We're talking Tyson Foods will own the hatchery. It will own the feed mill. It will own the slaughterhouse. It will own the company that breeds birds. It will own the trucking line that ships the birds back and forth and then ships the meat out to a warehouse. That integration is at the heart of chickenization, but the word means a lot more than that. When a business becomes chickenized, it essentially means farmers become powerless. Transparent markets are replaced by contract arrangements. And companies get a tremendous amount of control over the business.
And the number of companies that actually control what gets to your plate is actually fairly small now.
That's right. That's one of the most significant changes in this whole business. I interviewed Don Tyson and his close confidants and lieutenants who built the company, and their goal was really clear. They wanted to be big. They wanted to be big, as big as possible, because that really helps the company survive and fatten its profit margins in a pretty volatile business. So Don Tyson went on a just unprecedented acquisition spree. I mean, Tyson Foods bought at least 33 of its competitors, and some of those were major large chicken companies like Holly Farms. And it went from a point where we had a highly competitive chicken industry in the 60s and 70s, to a system today where just three companies make about half of all the chicken in the United States, and just two companies make about 40% of the chicken in the United States. And the impact of that is significant, and it's serious for consumers. I document how in 2008, Tyson Foods really hit a rough patch, where prices for chicken went down, but prices for feed were still high. So what Tyson did to react to that was it cut production. That's a natural reaction, right? Well, the difference between 2008 and 1961 is that Tyson Foods controlled almost 25% of the market. These companies have a market power that is unprecedented in the United States, and it gives them a strong lever over the meat industry, and the results have been really clear. Tyson was able to cut production. It has done that many times since 2008. And its profits are rising. It reported record profits last year, even as meat prices go up.
So let's say you're a chicken eater like I am, and you're really bothered by how the system has evolved. Is there anything we can do as consumers? What choices are out there?
Well, certainly everybody has to make that decision for themselves. I eat chicken, and I do not advocate a vegetarian diet, although I really understand why some people do that. I understand where they're coming from. I just do think chicken is an affordable source of healthy protein. I think the most expensive option for people out there is to simply opt out of this system. I mean, there's a really vibrant movement of, you know, this quote-unquote locavore movement, where you can go to a farmer's market where a local farm will sell chicken on a subscription basis. You know exactly where that chicken's raised. 100% of the food dollar you're spending goes to the farmer. But That's expensive. I think it's about three times as expensive. And that's asking a lot of consumers. Yeah. And I mean, look, I'm writing about the meat that's delivered to hospitals, cafeterias, grocery stores. Most middle-income Americans can't afford to buy meat at the farmer's market. And unfortunately, I think with the issues I'm talking about in this book, there's not an easy fix. What we're looking at is a system that has basically gone back 100 years to being in a state of oligopoly, where a few companies have tremendous market power and competition has dwindled significantly. I think part of the solution probably has to be political. I mean, the only entity, when you look around at the landscape, what entity could help curb the power of a corporation that has, you know, almost $1 billion in profit? I think federal antitrust authorities are about the only people in the landscape that could help curb some of the market power these companies have been given.
Thank you, Christopher, for joining us. You've certainly given us a lot to think about today.
Thanks so much for the time.
Christopher Leonard is a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of The Meat Racket. Jennifer Aide Lee is the publisher of Daily Lit and the author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles. Well, for more information, head to the website, splendidtable.org. You know, if Jane and Michael Stern didn't exist, we'd probably have to invent them, because nobody else has their take on finding local eats. Jane, Michael, I have missed you guys. Welcome back.
Hey, Lynn.
Thank you. We missed you, too, although we missed you some of the time, the rest of the time we were eating, so we didn't miss you that much.
You should miss me when you're eating. Okay. I want to be with you when you're eating.
we're too busy.
All right. Pertinent to our subject, what have you been eating?
We've been eating soup. We've been thinking about soup anyway. And one of the things that occurred to us is that as much as any other food, soup has such regional characteristics. And I'm not talking about the obvious things like New England-style clam chowder versus Manhattan-style clam chowder or Virginia
versus Rhode Island
versus
style.
Rhode Island style versus Pacific Northwest style. I mean, there are certain soups that are that really sing of where they're from. One of the most obvious examples is Virginia peanut soup. You won't find peanut soup anywhere other than in Virginia.
And also, well, I don't know if this is really, it's not a soup, but I would classify gumbo.
Oh, well.
Maybe, I don't know, Lynn, do you think of gumbo as a soup?
I think of gumbo as a soup, but I realize it's more of a stew, but I think you could take it any way you want it.
Okay, well, let's put it as a regional soup. And I mean, obviously, gumbo is not from Montana. You know, so this is a terrific regional soup.
And it has so many forms.
It has, exactly. I'm thinking, you know, there's sausage gumbo, there's chicken gumbo, there's one of the great gumbos anywhere is out at Rocky and Carlos in Chalmette, which is
east
of New Orleans. It's a seafood gumbo with shrimp and crawfish, a meal's worth of shrimp and crawfish, plus, of course, okra, rice, and spice galore.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy, is right. Another one, I just have to say, in Lafayette, the Cajun capital of Louisiana, at Préjean's, it's a pheasant and andouille sausage.
Wow.
That is so delicious. I mean, it's like when I taste this, I think nothing can taste this good, nothing else.
What about some of the unexpected things?
Well, pot liquor. What do you think of that?
That's interesting because that's what you would be cooking your greens in, or you'd be, if I remember, boiling a ham in.
Exactly.
Right?
But then it's served alongside for dipping your cornbread in.
Ah, well, so and generally, technically it's a soup.
It's a soup. I mean, you get the pot liquor, and usually you get a bunch of greens in the pot liquor. At the little tea shop in Memphis, Tennessee, which happens to be the oldest restaurant in Memphis, they serve a pot liquor with – it's really interesting because, you know, the greens are kind of bitter in the best possible way. And on top of that is a thick slice of tomato, which by comparison tastes unbelievably sweet and fruity. And on top of the tomato is a slice of, like, crisp raw onion, and the combination of those with corn dodgers on the side is just this kind of spectacle of different flavors that all go together so well.
And if I can mention a word that the Sterns never mentioned, which is trendy, I would have to say that, like kale, that anything like dandelion, turnip, collard, mustard greens, those are going to be the thing for the next year or two. And so pot liquor will have a revival.
This is, you know, I think you're onto something.
Totally.
Anything in the Midwest or the West?
Well, how about artichoke soup out in artichoke country in California? I think we may have spoken about this wonderful restaurant in Pescadero, California, called Duarte's. It's been around for over 100 years. It used to be a stagecoach stop. And in the backyard of Duarte's, they have a huge artichoke garden where you see the most spectacular huge globe artichokes. And one of the specialties of the house, they make all kinds of things with artichokes, but is artichoke soup, which is just, it's a very simple soup. It's artichokes that are, you know, the leaves are pulverized with chicken broth and plenty of garlic, cream and butter. The combination is kind of, it's very rich and luxurious and smooth with a jade green color that makes it seem so healthy.
There you have it. Also, tortilla soup in the Southwest, she crab soup in Charleston.
It goes on and on and on.
Kale soup. You know, if you ever go to Rhode Island or southern Massachusetts, kale soup is everywhere. It's kind of a Portuguese thing.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Great stuff.
Fabulous. Thank you, guys.
Okay,
bye, sweetie.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds and the mouths behind roadfood.com. Now, check out their sleeves up dining picks at splendidtable.org and make your own great regional soup. Don't miss out on our vast collection of soup recipes on our website and on Pinterest. Coming up, what should one drink with salami, prosciutto, and bologna? And the cuisine that's been under China's thumb far, far too long. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
This episode of The Splendid Table is sponsored by NatureBox, the subscription service dedicated to smarter snacking. With a few simple clicks, tasty treats like banana bread granola and Honey Crunch crisps are delivered right to members' doors. They abide by strict quality standards, and products are made from wholesome ingredients and are nutritionist approved. Members discover new delicious treats in each monthly box, or they make their own selections. Get 50% off your order at naturebox.com/splendidtable.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Equality for all is Joshua Wesson's motto. As JetBlue's wine captain and co-founder of the bestsellers chain of wine stores, he is the man to go to for information before you begin wandering those wine aisles. Josh, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay, so I'm the person who has the charcuterie or the, you know, pork belly for dessert at a restaurant. What's your take on wines with charcuterie?
Well, I mean, as amazing an array of producers, you know, as you can find right now for artisanal charcuterie, there's not the same amount of wisdom out there when it comes to pairing cured meats with wine. In fact, the default setting, if you were to spend a couple of hours Googling that question, would be medium to full-bodied reds, which are exactly the wrong kinds of wines.
Yeah.
And they're wrong because when you have a lot of alcohol and a lot of structure in a red wine, and then you start tasting foods that are salty, the salt can exaggerate the alcohol and sort of blow the wine up right on your palate. So the conventional wisdom, what little there is out there, is not so wise. You've got to replace it with something that makes a little bit more sense and tastes better.
So what would that be?
Well, I think whenever you're having foods like charcuterie that have salt and fat and savory spices and textures that can run the gamut from silky and moist to really, really dry and intense, you got to look for beverages that are refreshing, that can cleanse the palate. And that means wines that can be chilled, wines that are low in alcohol and high in acid, sometimes wines that are a little bit sweet, and sometimes wines that have a few bubbles in them, which is really pushing you in a direction more towards white and rosé and fizzy rather than still, and certainly low in alcohol rather than high.
So some names for us.
Well, I love Prosecco with all kinds of charcuterie. I love not terribly complex sparkling wines coming from just about anywhere with all different kinds of charcuterie. And probably my favorite would be Lambrusco from Emilia-Romagna, sparkling red wines that are just absolutely amazing with just about any kind of charcuterie you put in front of them. But I also love modest white wines that don't have any oak, things like Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand, Albariños from Galicia in Spain, Chenin Blancs from the Loire Valley or from South Africa. And one of my favorites, sort of just as a go-to white wine for charcuterie, off-dry Rieslings from the Mosel. Fantastic. Cabinet Rieslings are just amazing with all different kinds of charcuterie, especially prosciutto.
So now we know what to look for on the label. And it's so interesting because, as you know, I spent a little bit of time in Emilia-Romagna. And when you eat prosciutto di Parma in Parma, they serve it with a local white, they call it frizzante, a lightly sparkling Sauvignon Blanc that has a touch of sweetness. And it's like drinking spring. But the point is, there's no red on the table. And I have actually, well, there are people there that would never serve you butter and bread with your prosciutto, fruit with your prosciutto, or anything red.
I think that's wise advice. And that kind of wine, off-dry, sparkling white wine is just perfect. And you don't even have to have bubbles. Just an off-dry white wine would be great. Rosés go very well with a lot of charcuterie because they're red wines that think they're white. And you can chill them, of course, and they usually have beautiful mouth-watering qualities coming from the fruit or coming from the acid. And I don't mean to throw red wines under the bus here.
Right.
But if you're going to drink red wine with charcuterie, you best find red wines that are made in a lighter style, that are modest in alcohol, that don't have a lot of tannin, and that can be chilled slightly. Things like Beaujolais or Pinot Noir, especially Pinot Noirs coming from cool climates. I had a very, very delicious one from Erath, their estate Pinot Noir, for about $18, $19 from the Willamette Valley in Oregon. Just delicious with charcuterie. And probably my all-time favorite reds come from Beaujolais. And last week I was drinking a Trenelle Côte de Bruilly, which is a lighter style cru from Beaujolais, for about $15, $16. Insanely good with pâtés and salami and mortadella and rillette and lomo. It was one of those goes-with-anything kinds of wines.
I knew you'd have the answer. Josh, thank you.
Thank you.
Josh Wesson is JetBlue's wine captain and co-founder of the bestsellers chain of wine stores. Find his wine advice at splendidtable.org. Now, you can try your hand at making your own simple charcuterie with this recipe of saucisson of pork tenderloin. It's from Jacques Pepin's book, Chez Jacques. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Adrian Lowe and Abraham Conlin were two chefs without a permanent home. For years, they held an underground supper club called X Marks in Chicago, where they experimented with different kinds of cooking. Well, finally, they settled. They opened Fat Rice, cooking the food of Macau. It's a little-known cuisine from a tiny former Portuguese colony in China. Now, Macau, for all its modest size, has a culture that brings together a huge swath of the world. And that was thanks to its traveling Portuguese colonizers. Chilies from the New World, curries from India, coconut milk from Malaysia, mixed with the indigenous Chinese cuisine to brew up something totally unique. Well, editor Francis Lamb met up with Adrian and Abe in their hometown of Chicago.
Hi, Adrian and Abraham. Thank you so much for coming today.
Hi, Francis. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, you know, my wife's family is from Portugal. And my family is from China. So for years, we've actually joked that if we have a kid, we're naming it Macau after the Portuguese colony in China. And so when I heard that there was a restaurant in Chicago serving Macanese food, I was really excited about it. I was like, oh, I really got to go check it out. And then I find out that, well, the chefs aren't actually from Macau. And that, in fact, Abraham, your family is from Portugal.
Correct.
And Adrian, your family is from China.
Yes.
So I was like, oh, my God, they opened the restaurant version of our imaginary child. So how would you describe the cuisine of Macau?
The food in Macau is a blending of many cultures and the history of the Portuguese through their travels. Macau was the last place that the Portuguese ended up, and they brought everything
They brought all their ingredients from India, from Malaysia, from Africa, from Brazil, and it's kind of the final point where all of the discoveries, quote unquote, and all of the new ingredients were kind of brought, and then with the final addition of the Fukienese and the Cantonese ingredients and techniques, really kind of round out the cuisine to make this beautiful kind of harmonious home style of food that, you know, I think you in Macau, you see a couple different types of cuisine. You see kind of the restaurant based cuisine, which is very much a combination of Portuguese and Cantonese or Fukienese. And then in the homes you see, and in kind of the maybe more like blue collar restaurants and things like that, you see this, you catch more of the Malay influence, you catch more of the Indian Goan influence. Because, I mean, this is a food that was, it evolved from the home. You know, and I mean, my thought for a lot of this is, you know, I mean, anybody's experienced this if they come from a multicultural family. It's like, you know, the father might have something he wants to eat, the mother might have something that she wants to eat, and then, you know, the kid is kind of caught in between, and you know, and finally they just say, "Heck with this," they just throw it all together, and then the kid grows up with it and says, "This is my food, this is my home food."
Yeah, you know, yeah, and that's how I ended up eating fried rice with spam and canned corn when I was growing up.
Totally. Yeah.
But so what are some of these dishes? Like, what are some of the dishes that really show these different influences in Macanese food that you know of?
I think the pokok gai is one of the best examples, and that translates into Portuguese chicken. Interestingly enough, you'll never find this dish in Portugal. It is essentially a chicken and coconut curry that has olives, chorizo, sausage, lemon, and coconut crumble on top, and it's kind of baked in the oven to make this beautiful bubbly casserole. Sounds like it's not going to work together, but it's a beautifully harmonious dish that we, you know, that's super popular at Fat Rice. You could probably make a map with a chicken on a boat and start the recipe for chicken on a boat and start him off in Portugal and then move him to Brazil, to Goa, to Africa, to Malaysia, then to China and see how it changed. You know, the dish that we have is piri piri chicken, and it is simply a marinated and charcoal grilled chicken with hot sauce. And that's what you find in Portugal, that's what you find in South Africa. But the thing is, when you get to Macau, they call it Gainha de Africao. So it's African chicken. And they actually cover it in a sauce. They not only grill it and then put the piri piri hot sauce on it, but then they put onions and garlic and ginger and tomato, possibly some coconut, and then peanuts in the sauce as well. And that's how we serve it at Fat Rice, and we it gets covered in that sauce. And again, a lot of Macanese based dishes are baked after they've cooked the initial time to get this kind of beautiful crust on it.
So Adrian, for you, what keeps you inspired to learn more and to dive more into this culture?
Well, I think a big part of Fat Rice is this preservation. We kind of witnessed this when we were in Macau, this culture and this food that is just disappearing. And it's really saddening. It was, you know, it was very difficult for us to actually discover the food while we were there. We were kind of, you know, on the hunt the whole time. So about this preservation, you know, at Fat Rice, we do a couple dishes. We do the bakalyao, which is Abraham's great-grandmother's recipe. So again, that's something that we're preserving. We do these boiled peanuts that were originally my grandfather's recipe. And it's something that my dad made when I was a kid growing up. And it's something that, you know, we're continuing to make. Because again, these things that if you don't continue to make them, they'll just disappear.
Yeah. And some of those dishes that you mentioned are aren't strictly Macanese.
Exactly, right. And that's the thing is that they aren't. They're not Macanese at all. They do have dishes that are strictly Chinese, you know, directly from my family. And we have things that are directly Portuguese that are directly from his family. Yep. So,
because ultimately food is personal. And I think we wanted to start, like when we started Fat Rice, we didn't want to say we're doing traditional home-style Macanese food. We said we're doing the food of Macau. Food of Macau incorporates, yes, there is the traditional Macanese, but there is also straightforward Portuguese, straightforward Chinese, you know, and, and the lines get blurred.
This is like that imaginary kid my wife and I have.
Right.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming today, Abraham and Adrian.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Adrian Lowe and Abraham Conlin are the chef owners of Fat Rice in Chicago. And Francis Lam is an editor-at-large at Clarkson Potter. Now, Abe and Adrian left us with a recipe to get us started. It's Macanese Minchi. This is minced meat and potato, and it has garlic, fried onions, and soy sauce. And you're going to find it at splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for us to connect. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Catherine's calling from San Francisco. Catherine, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about kale salads, in particular reducing balsamic vinegar with them. They're all over the city right now, and one that I've gotten really attached to, which is a really simple balsamic vinegar and olive oil dressing, and I've tried to recreate it tons of times. And I asked them how they did it, and the chef said that they reduced the balsamic vinegar quite a bit. When I tried, it just went so flat. It was almost as if I just, like, evaporated all the complexity out of it.
Right.
And I wanted to know your thoughts on what happened and how, how I reduce vinegar to get that really caramelized effect.
Yeah, and that's a trick that a lot of people use because, you know, the real balsamic vinegar, the way it's made is very complex and it has all these different levels of taste, and also it's very dense, it's very thick. But it's also wildly expensive, and this is not the same, but when you boil that down to a syrup, it's really delicious. Here's one trick. For about every half cup of vinegar, you want a half tablespoon of brown sugar.
Oh.
And the other thing is, which vinegar right now are you playing with?
The exact brand.
Yeah, because some brands are really, vinegar and corn syrup, and some brands have some vague resemblance to balsamic vinegar. And there are a few brands I know really work with this, and they're not wildly expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Costco has a balsamic vinegar. You buy it by the quart, which means you'll have it for a year.
Yeah.
But it's not a bad vinegar on its own, but it reduces really nicely.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's around anymore, but Fini, F-I-N-I, really good. But just with what you've got right now, figure for every half cup, you have a tablespoon or so of brown sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And that will give some dimension to that boiling down process.
Okay. Curious what your thoughts would be on substituting honey for sugar. I try to do that.
Don't do it.
Don't, no.
It's
okay.
A completely different flavor family. It's going to throw off that vinegar. Even the very simple commercial brands, there's complexity there. And the honey gets in the way. The honey is good with, boiling honey with vinegar. Other vinegars, great idea, wonderful combination.
Mm.
Yeah, and it becomes something called a gastrique.
Cool.
And it's delicious as the base of a salad dressing.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay, brown sugar, I'll give that definitely a try.
Give it a shot. I think you're going to like it. And that's the depth you're probably tasting in that dressing.
Yeah, I didn't ask if they added anything else to the vinegar, but...
Well, remember, while you're boiling it down, if you're doing it... Now, first of all, when you boil it down and you finally get it where you want it, you can make a quantity and just keep it in a bottle or whatever.
Mm-hmm. It's not, nothing's going to happen to that. But the other thing is you could be boiling it down with a shaving of orange zest. You could boil it down with some chopped shallots or with garlic. Yeah. You boil it down with an herb. Like sweet herbs are generally wonderful, like basil. You could have a wardrobe of these things.
Oh, my gosh. That sounds so exotic and wonderful. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's fun. Go forth and make salad.
Okay. Here and, I go.
Okay,
thanks
Catherine.
Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Coming up, more of your calls, and Professor Marion Nestle tries to unravel the farm bill for us. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. Now, we're back to talk to you. Remember, you can always get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Bob is on the line from Cincinnati. Bob, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Pleasure to talk to you. I've got a wonderful spice shop here in Cincinnati, and the gentleman's got hundreds and hundreds of fresh spices, and I love going in there and just getting lost in all the aromas. And while I've got a basic spice selection, I was curious as to what you would suggest would be some really, the staple spices to have, and what are maybe some special ones that would be good to have to help add some flavor to my different dishes.
Well, first of all, let's start with what kinds of foods do you really enjoy? What kind of things you like to cook or you're curious about cooking?
Well, I really like to do some Asian cooking and some Mexican. So I've got a variety of peppers and ancho chilies and those kinds of things. And some curries, those kinds of things. I'm
right,
curious
right.
to what are some things I might want to try and expand into.
First of all, think about whole spices. Get a spice grinder, even a secondhand coffee grinder. You could use
which I have an old coffee grinder.
So buy whole spices because they're going to last longer, and grind them as you need them. You grind up a cinnamon stick and you're going to be blown away.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, there are two spices I am using a lot, and I am using it in everything. I mean, just basic stews. I use it a lot in my Asian cooking. I use it a lot in my cooking from almost anywhere in the world because of what they do. And that literally is cinnamon and allspice. And I grind them fresh. And if you're doing anything from Morocco, if you're doing anything that comes out of the Americas, South America, or, you know, the United States, also anything coming out of Asia, it is just a wonderful backdrop to go into a curry or whatever. You could also add them whole. If you're thinking India, if you're thinking Mexico, cumin and coriander.
Yep.
All of these four I'm talking about are North Africa as well and the Middle East. So you see, you're covered that way. One of the things I love to play with in Chinese cooking especially is star anise. And star anise is a beautiful thing. It looks like a star, and you can break off small pieces of it and grind it, or you just drop it whole. It's very powerful, but it's really delicious. And if you're making like a dusting of sugar for a cookie or whatever, you grind up the star anise, and you toss that with sugar, and you just put that over a cookie before you put it in the oven. It is just an amazing flavor. So star anise would be fabulous. I'm thinking of the unusual things right now.
Sure.
I keep dry spices because I use them in combination with fresh. So I have dry oregano. I have dry basil. I buy the whole leaf. I buy only enough for 3 months. I used a bit of turmeric for its health reasons, but also because it adds an acrid, interesting flavor. I collect paprikas. I keep those in the refrigerator. There's regular Spanish sweet. There's smoked sweet. There's smoked hot. There's Hungarian, which has a more vegetable quality, and there is California sweet paprika that is really sweet, and it's worth looking for. And then Sichuan peppercorns, delicious not just in Chinese cooking. Whole cardamom pods. Whole cardamom pods with vanilla in any kind of custard that you're making.
And isn't there a couple of different types of cardamom pods?
Yes, there's a black cardamom, which is stronger, often favored in a lot of Indian cooking. And then there is a green cardamom. And, of course, the pods you can just throw into a dish because they'll flavor. But if you crack them open, you get the seeds that you can grind. If you take an apple pie and you grind up a little bit of cardamom and you grind up a part of a vanilla bean with that, with the sugar that's going to go in the apple. And then if you want to, you can add the cinnamon or whatever, but you just do that for an apple pie. It will make you a very happy person.
Okay.
So that'll get you started.
Okay.
Oh, I know the other thing I keep around all the time is whole fennel seed. Just, okay. It's again, not a lot of it, but just a backdrop. You're making soup. Throw in whole fennel seed. You know, a vegetable soup. It just adds something.
Sure. Hey, thanks so much. I enjoy the show so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Aubrey's calling from Olympia, Washington. Aubrey, hi. What's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I'm so excited to speak with you.
Oh, I'm glad.
Well, just this fall, I was at a fundraiser at an off-the-grid ranch in southern Washington, and they have a wine and micro beer bar at the fundraiser, and a woman who is familiar with the ranch came with something she had made to serve at the wine bar, and it was delicious and terrifying.
What was
terrifying? I wanted to know what it was and if I could make it. She brought it in a white bucket. It was a 5-gallon bucket, and it was fruit and rum and sugar. And she sort of briefly described the process. She would pick whatever seasonal fruit was available at the time. She would put a handful of it into the bucket, put a handful of sugar in, and then cover it with rum. She said it was German in origin, but that's all she gave me. And we all tried it. No one died. but I'm interested in, you know, the origins and the process, and like I said, whether or not we could give it a shot at home.
I'm laughing because you know that old saying, what goes around always comes around, or keep something long enough and it'll come back into fashion or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Well, years ago, this was a very big deal, okay? It's called a Rumtopf. Now, it's probably been a big deal in Germany since, you know, day one. But here in the United States, there was a time when you would go into almost any kitchen store and there would be Rumtopf jars. Mm. And when I finally got to Europe, I realized, you know, in Germany, everybody sells Rumtopf jars and it says Rumtopf on it and it's made out of ceramic or porcelain. And this is the idea. As fruits came into season, usually summer fruits, starting with, you know, strawberries and then the berries and then the stone fruits, you would preserve them. And you would do, I don't remember the exact proportions, but you go online and look at Rumtopf and you will find proportions. But this exactly what she talked about. You would start out with a layer of sugar at the bottom of any kind of non-reactive container. Ideally not glass because you want to keep it dark. I would use either stainless steel or I would use porcelain, for instance. This is the idea. You put in a layer of sugar, the fresh fruit, another layer of sugar to completely cover it, and the alcohol to cover. And you use rum. And ideally, you don't need to use a super expensive rum, but you want a nice rum, okay?
Sure.
And you do that through the summer. You don't do apples. Pears are evidently pretty good, but apples evidently get kind of funny tasting. And generally, you quit in the fall, and you let it sit, and you have it lightly covered. Okay, but, you know, a little air can get in there. You don't want it sealed. It may blow up. So the thing is that by Christmas, you would have fruit that was densely flavored and delicious in pies on things like cake and whatever, or on their own. But you'd also be able to tipple that lovely rum fruit drink that you now have as a cordial. And that's what you do. That's
it. The way that we had it was we used the syrup as part of a mix in a drink, and some people used a micro beer, an amber ale. Some
that would be interesting.
Red wine, and I drank it with sparkling water. And they put the preserved fruit into the glass with the drink, and the plums were the best, I have to say.
But you can choose to put in your Rumtopf anything you want.
That's amazing.
I mean, within reason. But generally, those summer fruits and berries are the things that really fly. And you've got fabulous berries in your neck of the woods. But plums, you love plums?
Well,
put a lot of plums in.
I love them in the drink, for sure.
Well, I would say, yeah. But also, no, you can do a lot more with them in terms of cooking and that kind of thing and sauces. So it's a great deal. And it's a great gift also for people.
Thank you so much. And what would be the warning signs if it were not to be safe?
Any kind of mold. Right. Any kind of mold and any kind of off scent.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just has to smell like ambrosia, and we're okay.
Yes, you're fine.
Okay.
Thank you
so much.
Okay. You are welcome. Enjoy it. Bye.
Thank you.
800-537-5252. The new farm bill scores high on the scale of instigating strong opinions from all sides. Dr. Marion Nessel of NYU is one of the people commenting on the bill. She is the shaper of one of the broadest academic food programs in the country. That is NYU's Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health. She's written three seminal tomes, Food Safety, What to Eat, and Food Politics. Marion, it's good to have you back.
Oh, glad to be back.
Well, Marion, your blog, Food Politics, a little while back, had a statement in it that you made that got my attention and probably a lot of other people. You said, this farm bill is politically corrupt.
Yeah, I did say that.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. So I think I'd love to hear some of the specifics that you're looking at here.
Sure. I mean, it's very difficult to understand the Farm Bill without understanding its history and without understanding the way our political system works. But the Farm Bill from the get-go, all the way back to President Lyndon Johnson, was set up to be political right from the beginning because Johnson was worried that he couldn't get a food stamp program passed to meet the needs of the poor in urban areas in a country that was mainly rural and cared about agribusiness and farmers in the Midwest. And he didn't think that the Northeastern and the urban areas in the country would vote for supports for agribusiness. And so he logrolled. He put them together in the Farm Bill so that they're inextricably tied. And that politicizes the whole thing right from the beginning, where nobody is sitting back and saying, what is the best way that we could support agriculture in this country in a way that will make sure that farmers make an adequate living, that farm workers are paid decently, and that we have an agricultural system that promotes health and supports the environment. That's not what's happening. What's happening is everybody is competing for their own piece of the federal pie. And what you see are these really ugly battles over food stamps and over direct payments and over a system that taxpayers pay for that supports agribusiness and the largest elements of agribusiness at that. I thought it was not an accident that President Obama signed the Farm Bill in front of a John Deere tractor, where Deere is one of the few companies that is able to provide crop insurance, so it benefits enormously from the bill. And, of course, the Deere company is a very generous donor to members of Congress.
Yeah, there's evidently a lot of debate and dissatisfaction about the crop insurance part of this bill, but could you explain this?
Not very well. What I can say, what I can say is that taxpayers pay 62% of the premiums, so the government pays for it. When I taught a course on the Farm Bill, and the class read the section on crop insurance and the documents that had been written about the crop insurance program, they said we should be in the crop insurance business. You get the premiums, and if there's a failure, the government pays for it.
So essentially, a farmer pays for crop insurance, but he's subsidized or she is subsidized in that payment.
Right.
But isn't this something that's really helpful to a farmer? Because, this, you know, you roll the dice every time you plant for a season. A rainstorm can take you out.
Yes. But we're not really talking about farmers benefiting from the Farm Bill. When I think of farmers, I think of, you know, these bucolic people growing family farms and fruits and vegetables with a few cattle and so forth. That's not who benefits from the Farm Bill. Agribusiness benefits from the Farm Bill. This is supportive agribusiness, which is doing very, very well these days and has for years. So, you know, I wish that farmers were helped by the Farm Bill. And maybe the crop insurance will help some of them, and that would be wonderful. But that's not where most of it is going.
One of the things that was complained about for a long time was this idea that the subsidies, the aid for farmers, goes to farmers who are doing large-scale commodity crops, the soybeans, the corn, et cetera, but not to the farmers who are growing the five a day that we're being told we
should eat. Absolutely not.
And it is, but has that changed with this bill?
No, I don't think so. There used to be a clause in the direct payments to farmers that forbade them from growing fruits and vegetables if they were getting subsidies for corn, soybeans, and so forth. That presumably has been eliminated, and I'm not sure how that works now. That might be an incentive to have agribusiness go into fruits and vegetables. That's either good, bad, or indifferent, depending on how you feel about how they grow these things.
Well, and what are your feelings about the food stamp cut? Because that's been a subject of a lot of conversation.
Well, the best thing that you can say about the Farm Bill is that it could have been a lot worse. Certainly, the Republicans in the House were eager to cut food stamps by an extraordinary amount. As it is, the cut is about 1%, and not nearly as horrible as it could have been. So people who are looking at it from the outside say, not bad. You know, there's an $800 million cut a year that's, you know, not so terrible. That's about $50 a person a year. Everybody can handle that. They're not poor. They're not experiencing what it's like not to have any money and to try to get through a winter and to try to get through life with very little money and in an economy that just doesn't have any jobs.
But there are some positive sides, supposedly.
There are. There are little tokens scattered throughout the bill that do lovely things for organics, for farmers' markets. It looks to me like there's money for Food Corps in the Farm Bill. That would be terrific. You know, that's the group that goes into schools and teaches school kids how to garden and do other life skills like that around food. I think that's absolutely terrific. And so sprinkled in and out, there are a bunch of things that are probably quite useful and that will help people who are trying to work with the poor and low-income groups about trying to eat more fruits and vegetables.
Well, at least there's some encouragement.
There's some encouragement. Yeah. It's not as much as I would have liked to see.
Well, Marion, it'll be interesting to see what happens 5 years down the line with the next bill.
Oh, I can't wait.
Hey, thanks for talking with us,
Marion.
My
pleasure. Anytime. Bye-bye. Bye.
Marion Nestle is Paulette Goddard Professor of the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and Professor of Sociology at New York University. Her blog is Food Politics. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from President Eisenhower. He said, "Farming might look mighty easy when your plow is a pencil and you're 1,000 miles from a cornfield." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. You can head to our website to get information on just about everything you heard here today. You can browse through our recipes, visit our online store, and you can check out all the editions of our ebooks, Eating In with Lynn. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Manda Lilly. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.